Hi, good evening, everybody. My name is Richard McGregor from the Lowy Institute. Before I introduce our guest, Kevin Rudd, I'd just like to acknowledge we're on Gadigal land and to pay my respects to the traditional owners, past and present. You'll notice there's a third chair. We're actually going to have Chris Johnston from the CSAS in Washington coming up, but I'll introduce him properly later on when he joins us. Now, to Mr. Rudd, he's obviously one of those people who needs no introduction, but we'll get one anyway. Diplomat, bureaucrat, Prime Minister twice, now President of the Asia Society Policy Institute in New York. I had Queenslander down there, but I cut that joke out, actually. He's also a PhD student at Oxford at the moment. I was in touch with your supervisor the other day, and he said his student was doing very well. So it'll be Dr. Rudd soon as well.
Maybe.
Now, we're all pretty familiar with the contours of the current debate about US and China. I don't really need to go into great detail about that, so let's go straight to you, Kevin. I mean,
can these folks get a seat anywhere? I'm just worried about them standing up.
I think it's in such demand we've run out of chairs, so we'll see how we go. In the case of the US, you know, the potential pitfalls of a trade war are pretty clear. The US has voters, elections, shareholders and the like. What about in China? How does Xi Jinping see this dispute? What's his internal political calculus? What kind of pressure is he under at this point in time?
I think there are two factors at play in Xi Jinping's response to the trade war. One was how soft the Chinese economy was in 2018, and for reasons unrelated to the trade war, is to do with, frankly, a poor calibration of China's domestic economic policy. In particular, the attitude of the Chinese private sector, which for a whole bunch of policy reasons had become alienated from Xi Jinping's leadership. So if you saw the growth numbers through second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter 18, these were very, very thin. And certainly my own travels in China at the time, talking to Chinese entrepreneurs, it was not a good season. These folks were sitting on their hands, not investing their cash, and wondering what the future policy environment would be. So going into the politics of how to handle the implosion of the trade negotiations in early May, that's a big part of the background. I, Xi Jinping, have had a series of domestic economic problems, principally from the private sector. I've taken some corrective actions as of November last year. Growth numbers are turning round a bit, albeit purely through stimulus, not from the private sector. I'm worried about that. That's factor number one. So factor number two, however, is that in stumps Donald Trump, boom, 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 and says it's not a deal. And the Chinese have backtracked on X, Y, and Z, A, B, and C. And therefore, his famous tweet of the 5th of May, only about a month ago, which has drew things to, as it were, at least a temporary close. Those of you who study Chinese history, as many people here do, would know that the May the 4th movement had its 100th anniversary on virtually the same time as the Trumpster was reaching for his tweeting device, his tweet machine. And so the anniversaries which the Chinese leadership were most anxious about was the 100th anniversary of May the 4th movement, birth of Chinese nationalism 100 years ago, including the rise of the Chinese Communist Party in 1921, and then, of course, the centenary of the Tiananmen a month later. So in the midst of all those very sensitive Chinese political anniversaries, you have Trump kind of thundering in and saying, using the megaphone of the tweet, saying it's all off. So my understanding is that in the meetings in and around that time, that Xi Jinping and those around him saw a great political opportunity to circle the wagons, nationalist response to this, as described, overreach by the Americans and the intemperate nature in which the negotiations were concluded to have been a failure, accusing the Chinese of having changed their position in the way in which he did. And as a result, you then see unfolding this subsequent month of anti-American nationalist propaganda. So as described to me by some in China, this became, as it were, a political reconsolidation exercise for Xi Jinping as well.
But that's a political reconsolidation at potentially great economic cost. And he seems ready to wear that now, do you think?
Well, the question here is the timeline. A political reconsolidation. We should say, by the way, when we make that point, that Xi Jinping was not in any terminal political difficulty. He just had problems. And this provided an opportunity to circle the wagons. And you can run that strategy for so long, just as you can run a temporary stimulus strategy to plug the growth gap in the Chinese economy if the trade war continues for an extended period of time, and the Chinese are in the process of doing that. But longer term, when you start flipping into 2020, you start to have a substantial economic problem if there is a non-resolution to the trade war. So I'm still of the view, both for himself and for different reasons for Donald Trump, that these guys still want to get a deal done. Despite all the externalities of, let's call it, the political atmospherics and three-ring circus that goes on with it, that there is a driving need still to land this thing. So I don't think it can be left unresolved for eternity.
So just to go back to Xi's domestic political position, as you know, in the last year, there's been a lot of criticism, a lot of it surfacing in public, of Xi, or at least his positions, criticism about overreach on foreign policy, before Trump's intervention recently, maybe even messing up the US-China relationship. As you mentioned, his handling of the economy until he started to embrace the private sector late last year, his rollback of legal reforms, etc., etc. Even the Belt and Road has been under attack inside China. I mean, how should we judge all of that criticism of Xi? Does it matter? Does it weaken him? Does he mean he has to change the way he governs?
Well, Chinese Politburo politics is fascinating. And we're going to have Chris Johnson up here, a good friend of mine from the United States, soon. And he, like myself, is a bit of a tragic. And we've made this sort of a long-term passionate study of ours, which means we're essentially unemployable elsewhere.
It might make you very employable, actually.
Maybe it's finally come to a point of realization that people might want to know these things. But Politburo politics are fascinating. The leader at one level, the general secretary slash president of the country, is not just first among equals, but certainly in the case of Xi Jinping, given power consolidation, the number of people who were purged in post-2013 was not just primus inter pares, he was primus. However, running alongside of that is the number of people that you've alienated on the way through, the number of interest groups that you've upset. And it's not just the people who cop it in the neck, it's all their friends, rabbits, friends and relations, basically, if you read Winnie the Pooh, and this extended coterie of folks who get alienated on the way through, and including the military.
It's the bad enemies he's locked up as well, right?
Yeah, and the folks who have some connections with them. So the task of leadership in the rarefied atmosphere of Chinese Politburo politics is still to bring the group with you. So go to the critical dynamics of the Politburo meeting of the 11th of April this year, which is when the comrades sat down and then the draft text of what the negotiators... Have I stopped being recorded? I'm quite happy if I have, but I mean, God, now I can get really candid. But in that critical meeting of the 19th of April, there are different accounts as to what happened. But this was Liu He, as you know, the principal negotiator on the Chinese side, comes back. And this is a review session for the Politburo on what should have been the bow tie around the deal, except it didn't turn out that way. And as I understand it, some of the Politburo members, including some standing committee members, raised concerns and reservations about the text. And then, I won't say the floodgates were open, but then a general critique emerged as to what had been yielded to the Americans, at least as a negotiating text. The Chinese defensive position, correctly, is that nothing's agreed until everything's agreed. But what was fascinating is that Xi Jinping's management of reservations within the Politburo was not to simply stand by his man, Liu He, but to say, OK, you've got criticisms here, let's hear them. And then, having heard them, to actually ride with them and to accept that as the party's view. And then once those were reflected back to the Americans rejected them, Trump did his tweet, and then by the time you get to the 12th of May, I think, the Chinese formal position gets put into the nation's newspapers, which is, here are China's three fundamental red lines. And if you didn't get those straight, there was a big red line around them in the front page of, mysteriously, every Chinese newspaper that day.
Now, I should say
it's like News Limited. Have I offended anybody yet?
I should say the original negotiating text was about 150 pages that Liu He brought back. After the Politburo had put red lines through it, it went to about 70 pages, went back to the Americans, and that's when the Americans and the Trump tweet came. How did it get to the stage where they have this document with a bow tie about to come on, and the Chinese suddenly just decide this is national humiliation, should they have to sign it?
Well, I think one of the things we often find difficult to comprehend from the outside is the particular significance which this one-party state, Chinese Communist Party, attaches to these major national anniversaries. And Wu Si, the May the 4th, is no passing deal. It's a major event in the psychology of the Chinese Communist Party and the psychology of Chinese politics generally. It's the birth of Chinese nationalism. Why? For those of you who are not students of this period in Chinese history, because the Americans at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 sold China down the drain by handing what were then German colonies in China, not back to China, but giving them to Japan. Woodrow Wilson broke his word to the Chinese government and people. Previous to that, he was being lionized in China as the great man of our age, restoring dignity to the Chinese nation. He then did a deal with the other great powers and the Japanese and sold China down the gurgle. That's the anniversary we're talking about. So in the midst of all of that and the birth of Chinese nationalism and political radicalism, which occurred at the time, as you know, as a student of the period, we as outsiders would say, yeah, it's like Anzac Day 100 years ago. You know, what's it mean in terms of today's politics? Yes, it's significant, we're respectful, etc. But no, the legitimacy factor of the Chinese Communist Party within the fabric of one-party state is acute. So what many of us didn't quite judge correctly, I think until I spent 2 or 3 weeks there and spoke to a bunch of people, was how raw this sentiment was, and because it funneled straight through to the ongoing legitimacy challenges of the party.
So one more US-China question. This contest, competition, conflict, whatever, it's multifaceted. It's over trade, it's over geopolitics, it's over regional politics, it's over technology, it's over ideology as well. And there was a time when I think both sides knew that, and so they made sure they didn't run into each other. Right now, it seems the US is sort of bringing the confrontation on for fear of leaving it too late. So what's your assessment of whether the two sides can dial it down, back off? And that's obviously a question of great importance for countries like Australia.
If I'm not seeking to be equivocal about this, but I've said now for several weeks that I think we're really into 50-50 territory about the likelihood of producing an agreement. The economic argument in the minds of both camps is overwhelming. Get this thing done. China's economy has been relatively weak domestically. There's a brave face being put on the amount of stimulus that which can be delivered to plug the growth gap. If we end up in a full-scale trade war, currently calculated about 1.4% of GDP. So they can get away with that for a season. But then it really starts to add up. Similarly, Trump's got an election year next year. So do you want this thing to trigger an end to the business cycle because, you know, Wall Street's skittish? You're 10 years into a business cycle, the longest, almost now the longest in US economic history, without a recession. Do you want this to be the thing which flips sentiment over the edge? Well, the Trumpster knows two things. One is I read opinion polls, and two is I read the Dow. That's all the Trumpster's interested in. You know, for people who observe his behavior in the Oval Office, these two things are his barometers of success: political success, economic success. So he knows how skittish Dow sentiment is on the question of can there be a deal done on trade. So he, at that level, wants it done. So the question is, the economics is an overwhelming case to get it done. And the politics is one about saving face. If you look at the three Chinese red lines, as I think I wrote in this morning's piece in the City Morning Herald, I think Trump can yield on two of those three to deal with the future of the tariff regime. And the Chinese can yield on the third of those three, which is upping the scope and size of the proposed Chinese purchasing order from the Americans. Mind you, the third country consequences of that, including for countries like Australia, may not be insignificant.
So let me ask you then about, you mentioned stimulus. Your last big speech, I think, overseas was to the Harvard Business School, and that was about the economy. As you say, you know, the Chinese stimulus to keep, you know, to sort of alleviate the impact of any trade war can't go on for too long. There's been a big debate inside China, as you know, about the type of stimulus they do, with the central bank pushing back against the sort of bank lending splurge that happened in 2008, 2009. In Australia, the Morrison government re-elected had a firm commitment for a surplus, I think next year, if I'm correct. A large part of that is, frankly, iron ore prices, over $100 a tonne at the moment. That goes straight to the budget bottom line. What's your assessment of the debate about stimulus in China what kind of stimulus we'll get? Will we get an old-fashioned one, which in fact goes to construction and infrastructure, or can they recalibrate to fit the new modern Chinese economy based on consumption?
I think the overwhelming imperative from Xi Dada himself, Uncle Xi, is just make it work. Xi Jinping's not an economist. He's not a finance guy either. His imperative will be, we need 6% growth minimum to sustain social stability, because that's what you need for people in employment or emerging onto the labour market to get a job. That's the calculus point about what sustains social and therefore political stability. So for him, the rest will be details. What do the rest of the team say about that? I think what the Liu He, Feng Xinghai people will be saying, those who understand how markets work in the Chinese system, is given our central problem with the Chinese private sector in 2018 and to some extent prior to that, what do we do to adjust rapidly the policy settings for these folks? So what I anticipate is what's been done both in credit policy and in tax policy to help Chinese SMEs, and not just SMEs but big Chinese private firms, are further measures on tax and liquidity. Simultaneously, because they actually are rolling out a very big urban transport set of infrastructure initiatives, in particular metros, that this can be scaled up hugely and rapidly across China's second-tier cities, given the size of China's second-tier cities. Most of them are bigger than Brizzy. It's my benchmark for the world, actually, is that can command a lot of activity, and because of its geographical distribution, it can do the job as well. And so if it's the latter, to what extent does it create a demand for steel in the construction business? I've seen some literature to suggest that you'll see commodity prices held up as a result of that.
So just on that same topic, there's the tension between Xi and the private sector. He's been very much on the record, even till mid last year, going up to the Rust Belt in the Northeast, talking up the state economy. The private sector, of course, is responsible for 70% of output in China. He's neglected them. He appeared to do an about turn last year. I mean, is that a real change of heart? Did some of his advisors finally get to him on that issue?
The advisor certainly got to him, but not being Xi Jinping's father confessor, I'm not sure about the nature of his soul and therefore whether there's been a change of heart or not. I think it's useful for us all to be aware of what's the private sector critique of Uncle Xi. I think number one is not just the binary between state sector, private sector, though that is in part the case, but remember that the private sector essentially operates in sectors of the economy where the state sector is not large and hasn't been large historically. There is some overlap and there is some absence of competitive neutrality where they are competing against each other, and I know a number of private firms in that case. Let's just say that's number one. Number two, where it becomes really acute, is in the allocation of credit and the ability to get daikuan, loans from the bank to roll things over, keep your business going. Frankly, in the credit distribution politics of local banks and financial institutions, because the bulk of the banks are publicly owned, they will favour SOEs, and they've done that historically, to often discriminating against private firms. So the lifeline of credit gets cut off. But the other big thing, which has alienated private firms, has been the absence for them of a manageable legal system. It's not just the capricious nature of the anti-corruption campaign, which can come and get you tomorrow morning if you don't have the right connections in place. It really is a problem in terms of what then happens if you're in a substantive commercial dispute, and it's the nature of the local, as it were, commercial legal system. And so the number of complaints I get from private entrepreneurs about one or other of these, put it together cumulatively, I felt it palpably from July last year, the private sector effectively beginning to conduct a private fixed capital investment strike. So his challenge, and certainly when his advisors came in the third quarter of last year and said, we've got a problem here, the response was acute. The 1st of October speech, bringing together 1,000 of the country's leading Chinese entrepreneurs with 10 speakers. I've spoken to a number of the people who spoke, all of whom have different accounts about what they all said, including what their friends said, they believed that he knew he had a problem and concluded that these were significant measures, which then followed on tax and credit. But on the question about whether China's fundamental economic policy environment changes in 2019, 20, 21, the jury in their mind is still out.
Okay, at this point, Chris, why don't you come up, and I'm going to get you both. We're going to talk a little bit about Australia and China. Chris Johnson from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, but also the former chief CIA analyst for China, and well recognized as one of the best analysts, I think, still on China. Just spent a few days in Canberra as well, and like Kevin, has also been up in China in recent weeks. But Kevin, we'll start with you. Australia and China, we've had a difficult relationship. I suspect it's going to keep being difficult. There's a number of flashpoints: the influence interference operations issue, the Huawei issue, the general issue of US and China and the like. How do you thread this needle for a middle power like Australia?
First of all, it's good to have Chris here. He's a good friend. I've got to know him since he's been at CSIS. I didn't know him in the CIA. He was not my handler. But on Chinese domestic politics, Chris is a really first-class analyst. On the US, on the Australia-China relationship, I think point one is it's always hard. It always has been hard. It's never easy. And certainly in our period in office, and Penny will remember this, having been Minister for Climate Change in my cabinet, there were rolling tensions with the Chinese government on a whole range of different things. But we still managed to prosecute a balanced relationship. China then was, by a country mile, our largest trading partner. It was becoming a significant investment partner. So the fundamentals of the relationship were not hugely dissimilar to what they've become today. But we were still able to manage differences. Remember, we had Stern Hu, we had Rabia Kadir, we had the attempted Chinese investment takeover of Rio.
Stern Hu followed that, I think.
Thank you for putting that in chronological order. We had defence white paper, the language used in it, and a few other things besides. So this was not just, all happy comrades swimming in the same revolutionary direction. We had differences. And that's structural. You go to the days of the Hawke government, they had structural disagreements with the Chinese as well. Go and speak to the people who worked with Gough back then, in the days of the Cultural Revolution. There were significant differences. So the challenge of being an Australian government dealing with China, including in this current period of mutual economic, I won't say dependency, because China doesn't depend on us as we do them in the economic relationship, is that you can still prosecute a balanced relationship. I suppose my last point is this. When I say that, what are the principles? I think there are just four of them, frankly, and maybe a fifth, very quickly. One, every meeting I've had with the Chinese leader, I'd say, we're a liberal democracy and we believe in universal human rights. That's never going to change because we are who we are. Okay, everyone clear about that? Good, tick. Okay, they don't like that, but that's just a reality. Number two, we're also an ally of the United States. And by the way, we, therefore, as an ally, and we've been that way for about 100 years, and it makes sense for us, governments of the left and the right, it's not going to change. But we also think that on key questions of foreign policy, Uncle Sam periodically screws it right up. Vietnam, Iraq, and a whole bunch of others as well. And so we reserve a right as an independent country to part company from the United States. They won't like it, but we have a track record of doing it. We don't set out to do it, but every now and then you run into a US administration which, strays off the reservation. And number three is within the framework of one and two above, we will, with China, prosecute a strong, comprehensive, political, strategic, economic relationship and to the maximum delivery of benefits to both sides. And four, importantly, particularly since we joined the G20, an important achievement for Australia. I'm proud of it being our government which got us there, is that we are now with the Chinese in the rolling institutions of global economic governance, including global collaboration on climate policy. Now, that means we're working cheek by jowl with China, and we should be on a continuing basis, on the big questions of global financial governance, global financial stability, global economic management, as well as global climate change action. And that's a whole positive terrain to work with our Chinese friends as well. I said there might be a fifth principle. I think it's this. Be very judicious about when you open your big mouth, okay? By which I mean Turnbull's egregious statement that the Australian people have stood up, that stuff that he did at the end of 2017. It was just nuts. It was this domestically, politically, self-indulgent nuttiness. I was in Beijing at the time. The whole debate in Australia about foreign interference, etc., is rolling along. By and large, no one was paying much attention up there in terms of central political leadership. This is stuff that happens in the West. And then suddenly, in thunders Malcolm, and he picks the phrase which Mao Zedong used on the 1st of October 1949. The Chinese people have finally stood up after 100 years of being screwed by the international community, and said, "And we're here." And so, what does Malcolm do? Picks that phrase, blabs it out in his own appalling rendition of Chinese, and then suddenly he was in every Chinese headline. Now, you want to pick the day when the relationship went, in my judgment, unnecessarily down the gurgle, it was that day. So just be judicious about when you embark upon public language. Be public when you absolutely need to, but the extent to which you can manage any difficulties which arise in a relationship, that's one of the reasons God invented diplomacy, okay? It's in the Old Testament.
Chris.
I think.
Chris, you neither have to defend Malcolm Turnbull or the US.
I will.
But you've just had the gamut of meetings with our national security state, such as it is in Canberra. But you also see a lot of other countries around the world, Singapore and the like, that are grappling with similar issues.
Right.
Give us your sense of how you see the debate from outside. We're going to get back on domestic politics, but from your meetings in Canberra.
Yeah, I think what Kevin said is largely right. There's a desire, I think, at some level to continue focusing on these critical issues. The interference issue, you know, remains and will continue to remain an important issue. Technology, obviously, is becoming huge, with the U.S. Now putting Huawei on the entities list and, you know, causing all sorts of trouble with that, you know, makes things very complicated. And I think just a general sense of the tension, right, between the desire, as Kevin said, to be who you are and who we are in our governance systems, but you have this unique problem, which is the economic 800-pound gorilla that you have to deal with every day. The U.S. has its own problem in that regard, but it's not as significant. So my strong impression was sort of, what do we do now? You know, we've kind of made a big hay, you know, and maybe we should do a little less of that, you know, here for a little while.
We've passed the laws.
Right. And I like the framing that I heard from several people down there on Huawei, which was sort of, look, we've done it. So no need to keep putting our hand up about it every 5 minutes. And I think that's exactly right. And frankly, we're busy doing it right now, so there's no need for you to. But I get sort of this sense of just sort of like, wow, that's been a bit exhausting. And so now what do we do next? And I think other governments are, to your question about Singapore and others, are feeling that. And then, of course, there's a profound sense of, and in all these governments that I deal with, would you just do it with us, meaning the Americans? And we're dying to help, and, you know, give us a shot, give us a chance, and stop doing it unilaterally.
But on that point, and I'll go to you first and then Kevin, of course, the Americans, there's Trump.
Yeah.
And then there's the rest of Washington.
That's right.
The U.S. seems to be simultaneously having a political nervous breakdown and getting its act together on China policy.
Yes.
And describe the China debate in Washington for us. Does the U.S. have a coherent China policy?
How much time do we have? I think we can take the analogy I like on this is we have a driver. And we have the car, right? And the driver is Trump, and the car is the bureaucracy, right? And the car is trying to go in a certain direction, very deliberately, as we saw in documents like the National Defense Strategy and the National Security Strategy, where we basically call it straight and say, you know, China's a strategic competitor and revisionist power practicing predatory economics across the globe. So that's a pretty straight statement. We had Vice President Pence's speech last fall, which, you know, put out some pretty strong stuff. And of course, as you guys both know, you know, when the Chinese read a statement like that from the Vice President of the United States, you know, that sometimes they struggle with the mirror imaging. In their system, that would be massive and it would be, you know, focused on and lots of careful language changes and so on, not just rolled out at the Hudson Institute, you know, which is, I think, one of the problems we're facing. So we see this tension all the time. And in fact, the so-called hawks inside the U.S. administration are often turned off, if you will, by Trump. You know, he's in the latest round with Xi Jinping, and as Kevin highlighted, the markets might be doing what he wants. He's getting nervous, and so he pivots back. And, you know, the best case example of this is the action against ZTE, the other Chinese telecommunications company. And, you know, 3 days later, it's, oh, sorry, we didn't mean that. It's all good, you know. And that national security system is going, what just happened? Not only that, our allies and partners are thinking that, right? Mm-hmm. So now with Huawei, a much bigger issue, that's all kind of coming to the fore again. And I just want to address something because it's important. You sort of suggested, you know, getting our act together on China. I agree. You know, the one thing I like about what the administration is doing is, you know, they call out a lot of things that frankly should have been called out. You know, my position is I often agree with some of the diagnosis. I rarely agree with the prescriptions. That's one point. The second piece is, I think, If you're doing these things nested in an overall strategy, that's one thing. But if you're just doing, shall we say, feel good actions because it's attractive to one's inner child, you know, to kind of punch the Chinese, then I'm not so sure. And I've not seen yet an exercise on my side where we are actually asking some fundamental questions. One is, are there any of China's ambitions we can accommodate? It's not clear from the administration's actions thus far that the answer to that is yes. If it's not yes, then maybe what I consider hoopla around the Thucydides trap and so on is more merited. Secondly, you know, if we decide there are some and some not, we need to define what the red lines are, you know, what those ambitions we do not want to see them undertake. We need to telegraph those very clearly to Beijing at a very senior level so they understand. And then we need to operationalize those red lines, right, so that they can see from our actions we really mean it when we tell them these are our red lines.
Kevin, what do you think? I mean, does the Trump administration leave countries like Australia exposed?
Well, let me give you one example where that could be the case. And that is, if you read Trump's consistent statements on Huawei, it's not just the...
Are they consistent?
They are in this sense. On the ZTE, I now use the American pronunciation, ZTE for the rest of us.
That's the smaller of the big telecommunications giants.
Yeah. So, as Chris just said, you have this flip-flop flap in 3 days, and everyone goes, okay, what the hell's happening here? Now, when he says repeatedly that Huawei, quote, can be rolled into a resolution of the trade negotiations, when A, the American deep state, national security community, is saying bad, 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 and this is on Huawei, and then the allies, led by the People's Republic of Australia, then roll in and say, fine, okay, we're with you all the way, and the Kiwis and not many others so far. And then what happens?
Not really the Kiwis, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. The I'm just reading just what the New York Times says. Yeah. It must be right. Then what happens if this is, quote, rolled in, and that's the end of the Huawei dispute? So thank you. We then left like the proverbial shags on a rock, and that's one of the grave strategic dangers of an American ally at the moment dealing with this bifurcated American administration, where there is Trump land up here, which is deeply transactional and deeply non-strategic in the sense of where does America want to be in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time? What is China's role in the future of that world? As Chris rightly posed the questions before, which of China's strategic aspirations are compatible with a long-term view of America's regional global role, which are not? That's not the way the Donald thinks. Never has been and never will be. So the danger which both European and Asian allies encounter with America's chief executive and commander-in-chief is, what does he say tomorrow? And the operational consequences in terms of an illustration are precisely on this Huawei matter. So you would have conservative government here, which would have burnt a whole bunch of political capital in the Huawei decision. And then suddenly the Donald says, nah, that was yesterday. You know.
Yes. Now, Chris, you've also been up in Beijing. We'll switch back to domestic politics before we go to questions, and also hearing about the famous Politburo meeting, which killed off the current stage of the trade deal. Mm. Give us your assessment of that and of Xi Jinping's position and how he handled that.
Yeah, I think this is actually really fundamental. And, you know, as Kevin said earlier, you know, for those of us who spend a lot of time doing this, it's all very fascinating. But it also, it's not just a angels dancing on the head of a pin analytic exercise. There are very serious policy consequences from getting that assessment right. You know, there's an old adage, right? Good analysis may not necessarily beget good policy, but bad analysis definitely begets bad policy, right? And so one version of this, which seems quite popular, frankly, among senior administration officials who I've dealt with, is that there was a group of course, unnamed ascendant hawks or vested interests or whatever you want to say in the Politburo who grabbed Liu He and Xi Jinping by the throat and said, you know, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. You know, that is ludicrous, you know, from my point of view. And
so that's kind of wish fulfillment that Xi Jinping got rolled.
Right, he got rolled. And you know, there's several consequences of that. One is, if you believe that, then you must logically believe he's at least on his back foot domestically, if not on the ropes, right? And therefore has very little ability to pivot back to what we might call the status quo ante, the document as such before they started cutting it to ribbons, right? The second, I suppose, follow-on consequence of that is that you might feel you need to do a favor for your friend Xi Jinping, right? When in fact, perhaps he's orchestrating the entire thing, as Kevin said, with this nationalist turn. So far more likely in my mind is that we saw a Xi Jinping who does what he does. It's really his chief piece of acumen, which is to see an emerging political landscape before there's anything to see.
Yes.
Get there first, dominate the high ground, in this case nationalism, and deny it to so-called hawks, you know, and so on, so that then he maintains maximum flexibility to pivot back. Mm-hmm. And here's the critical punchline. If you're trying to figure out these two bits, right, if you believe in the hawks piece and he's rumbled, you know, if you will, why not double down with a Huawei ban and so on? Because he can't get back to the beginning anyway. Mm-hmm. But if he has full flexibility and you do a Huawei ban, you've just made his job 100% tougher.
Was he just ahead
that
of the...
That analysis, yeah. I think, is yeah. absolutely right. About Xi Jinping's political psychology. The only coda I would add is that Chris and I have often discussed, how does this guy do this? My theory, which I don't know if he necessarily agree with, is that he is such a trained Marxist dialectician. He thinks in terms of Hegelian thesis, antithesis, cause, result, action, reaction. And he's always, as a consequence of his disciplinary process, two steps ahead of the game. Yeah. And therefore, he sees an emerging, as it were, window of opportunity for someone to take the commanding heights of the nationalist argument against he and his project with his best buddy Liu He. And he says, no, I'm not going to give you that. Thank you very much. Uncle Liu and I will go move over there. And in case anyone's got any doubts, as soon as this whole thing blew up, who does he take on his national guided tour of the country?
Liu
He, who's supposedly therefore in trouble if you take the U.S. nationalist takeover of the hard right of the Xi Jinping position. I think Xi Jinping domestically is a seriously master politician within the framework of Chinese Politburo politics.
That's terrific. So we're going to go for questions. We've got about 15 minutes, and I should stress, please, no speeches, only questions.
Thank you both for your insights tonight. Just wondering how you see strategic issues as bargaining chips on the table, particularly North Korea, if at all.
I think we've seen an interesting arc, I would say, in the role North Korea is playing in this. I think it's fair to say that when the U.S. began the maximum pressure campaign, there was a decided effort to work closely with China. And there was a carrot that went with it, which is help us on North Korea. Again, as Kevin said, you know, President Trump's sort of transactional thinking, help us on North Korea and you'll get trade relief. And in fact, they did help quite a bit. Arguably, I think this is something that's not discussed enough, perhaps. They gummed up that border like they haven't in a very long time in terms of cutting off flow into North Korea and so on. But their reward for that was not trade relief, but another $200 billion in tariffs. So their lesson was maybe not. And so there, I think there was a strategic reevaluation, and then they went, let's go back to what we know works, which is to control North Korea. And so that's the reason why we see multiple summits between Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un, when in the preceding 5 years there had been none. And, you know, I don't think they're flagrantly violating the sanctions, but they're certainly not working as hard as they were before. And they're sanctioning things like Kim Jong-un's interactions with Putin, for example. And now we see Xi Jinping and Putin and, you know, these sort of things. So I think that's how it's playing.
I think what I'd add is we've said before that Xi Jinping is, Trump's transactional. He is. But if you're an effective transactional politician in the great tradition of the Australian Labor Party, then a deal sticks. The Chinese strategic learning about this guy is that deals don't stick. That's the problem, even within transaction land, not even just in high strategy land. Does that make sense?
So it's a question to Chris, although, Kevin, you're more than welcome to jump in. It's, you know, it doesn't seem a good idea to start a fight unless you've got a really coherent end game in mind. Uh-huh. What do you think the US administration's end game is, having pushed this ball into play, particularly with Pence's speech?
Yeah. If you find out, let me know. No. all kidding aside, I think there's an idea that, and there's some very fair strands to this. I think, you know, there's a general sense, and I think this is really the core issue. Okay, we were a bit asleep at the switch on some issues. You know, some of this has to do with the U.S.-China relationship. Some of it has to do with things that, just in our own world, that we let happen, such as letting a strategic industry, telecommunications, disappear in the United States. We don't make this stuff anymore, you know, and so therefore there's not a lot of alternative to Huawei, which allied governments have been reminding us in various instances. I think if there's a trajectory, it's basically these guys don't play by the rules. The notion that having a deep intertwined economic relationship with them would bring some sort of, maybe not democracy, but a broader political opening, and that they would play by the general rules as set out after World War II, that was going to happen. You know, this administration's view is that was all a fallacy, that, you know, in its worst form, that the wily Chinese leadership over several, you know, iterations always meant to stick it to us, you know, and so on. And I mean, there's some truth in this, in that, as Kevin was highlighting earlier, the system cannot change because it will not open the political system. And if that's the case, you tend to see the same policies from them: industrial policy, subsidies, emphasis on state-owned enterprises. These things are eternal. And so the notion is, again, in its worst form, we better kill them off while we still have the chance, because, you know, they just don't align with us. I think what's striking is that I kind of like the EU's recent statement on this, where they said China is a systemic challenge to the rules-based international order. That's kind of a more measured way, I think, of putting it. There's a lot that they're doing, you know, that is troubling to us who kind of want to have a free, open approach. The risk, I think, becomes how we telegraph what I would call our narrative. And in some ways, the trade dispute, the IT Cold War, you know, that seems to be emerging and so on, these are symptoms of that broader competition, if you will, over narrative. And the Chinese have a narrative, and it's very clear, which is, we're rising, the U.S. is declining, we've brought 800 million people out of poverty, which is very attractive to the developing world, and they have kind of a strange narrative on the internet, but it basically is the internet injects deep fakes and terrorism and, you know, these sort of things into people's minds. We get rid of all that and just leverage the internet for prosperity, right? And again, it all sounds a bit goofy, but they blast it out so consistently that it can be sort of quite powerful. And the U.S. narrative with this kind of an approach, I think, is predominance, preeminence, you know, maintaining these things. That sounds backward-looking to me. It sounds like a country that is trying to cling on to things rather than have new achievements. And again, very sort of fearful, right? And what's more, what's compelling to allies and partners? You know, when they see the U.S. looking fearful, they start to think, we're going to start to be asked to make choices we don't want to make. And we're seeing some of this. So that's a problem I have with that strategy. Better to out America, if you will, and get back to our fundamental strengths. You know, 5G is a great example. Okay, rumbled. We didn't get there on 5G. Let's work on 6G, right?
I'm just wondering, what is the reason United States and Australia do not have a very strong stance with regards to China's treatment of Uyghurs? And also, would the response be stronger if Uyghurs are not mostly Muslims?
I'm actually glad for that question. I should have asked, in any discussion of China, we should talk about Xinjiang. It's almost mind-boggling, the level of detentions there. So I'll leave it to one of you two to handle.
On the question of Xinjiang, I'd just remind you, and maybe you weren't here at the time, but one of our historical problems with China when I was Prime Minister was over the visit here by Rabia Kadir. I remember
a Uyghur leader.
And so I remember this really multiple presentations from our Chinese friends at the time as to why we should not issue her with a visa. I hate to admit this publicly. I had no idea who Rabia Kadir was back then. I just didn't. I'm a reasonable student of Chinese history. Just it was not on my radar at the time. But then, and I would say this to my Chinese friends in the foreign ministry to take an important lesson out of this, At the point at which you go public and tell the Australian government they shouldn't issue such a visa is the point at which the Australian government then takes a decision to issue such a visa, which is exactly what we did. And of course, you know, we ended up in a huge prolonged dispute with our friends in Beijing over that. My point to the Chinese, who said to me at the time, was that she's a terrorist. I said, well, that's an Interpol matter. Can I see the file, please? Didn't come. And so I said, if it's a debate along those lines, then we will collaborate with any state in terms of people using acts of armed violence. So I would simply draw to your attention the fact that we have engaged as an Australian Labor government on these questions in the past. In terms of what's happening today in Xinjiang, what I would say is this: what I've always found in my engagements with the Chinese government on questions of human rights is that if the debate is framed in terms of two documents, that is the Universal Declaration of 1948, which has both been signed and ratified by China, and second, the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, which has been signed but not ratified yet by China, this is the framework through which you engage in a discussion with China about the treatment of its citizenry. And that, in my judgment, applies to the question of Xinjiang as well.
Chris, do you want to say on that?
Yeah, I think my quick comment would be the U.S. hasn't paid as much attention to this issue, I don't think, as we used to for a very long time. I'm putting aside the administration's general approach toward human rights, but you know, when we look at Saudi Arabia and we look at other issues, there's challenges. I would say that what's striking about the discussion now
is... That's the biggest understatement.
I'm abroad. I have to be careful. You know, I think the interesting piece is how active the Hill is becoming. And if you look at, for example, it's not directly related, but I think it is increasingly related, Speaker Pelosi's comments about the Hong Kong demonstrations yesterday and thinking about changes to Hong Kong status, which actually would be a disaster, but when that's separate. You know, we're starting to see, interestingly, with Hong Kong, the same phenomena, I would argue, we see with other, shall we say, sensitive areas for China, which is... they have a repressive policy. Sooner or later, it blows up, you know, in that respective area. And we're seeing this in Hong Kong now on a fairly regular cycle. And they do their best to squelch it, and you go right over again, you know. And so this is really the issue. When the U.S. considers policies, which they are very actively considering right now, such as sanctions against, you know, global Magnitsky sanctions, in fact, which are a very powerful tool, against Chinese companies that have supplied surveillance technology for the crackdown in Xinjiang, or perhaps against sitting party officials, very senior ones, who are overseeing things in Xinjiang, it's a double-edged sword in a way. You know, what I can assure you is it will not change their approach to Xinjiang. And in fact, probably what it will be to transmit to them, well, there's no bother being calm about this or trying to be judicious. This just gives us a license to crack down even harder. It's a shame that that's how they think, but that is how they think.
So my question goes to Mr. Rudd. I noticed that your PhD dissertation focused on Xi Jinping's worldview, right? So may I ask, what is your methodology, or how do you access these key information about the current top leader of China?
I just make it up.
Yeah. I was going to say, you've got to do a PhD defense in 2 minutes, please.
The reason I'm doing it, let me go to some fundamentals. Xi Jinping de Shijie Guan Ruhe. Is that every country I go to in the world, and my current job at head of an American think tank, I go to a few. That's the question I always get asked. What does this guy think, and what's he want? Where does he want to take China? It's a very valid question. It's such a fundamental point of, let's call it, geopolitical evolution, if it doesn't turn out to be transition, vis-a-vis these two great powers in the world. So that's why I'm doing it, because I get asked all the time. So secondly, you can either just shoot from the hip or the lip and say, I think this based on, I've had probably about 10 conversations with the guy. But methodologically, you've got to be systematic about it. So what I'm trying to do is to read everything that's attributed to him over time, including his provincial days. to find out what the common threads are in terms of how he thinks about politics, China's future domestically as a political entity, and frankly, you know, the Da Fuxing, the great Chinese, the Renaissance of the great Chinese people. So trying to put some systemology into what is attributed to him in terms of what he said. And then finally, talked to a whole bunch of folks who in China who have actually worked with him over the years to try and have some interpolation as to what key phrases actually mean and why they're actually used. I can add my own thoughts about that, but I'm not Chinese. I'm certainly not a member of the Chinese Communist Party, and I don't have a sense of a fully accurate feel as to what lights are lit up when particular phrases are used. So I'm seeking to make sense of it, but to answer your question about methodology, it's those two things. And then I make it up.
So we're going to have one last...
That was a joke in case someone rings.
One last question here. By the way, while the microphone's getting there, will your thesis be published?
Not if it gets me into trouble. No, I actually haven't crossed that bridge. It's got to be worthwhile yet. Yeah. So I've written two chapters of this bloody thing, and I've done definition and methodology. Oh, no, three. I've done theoretical framework. So I've done all the yucky bits, you know, which I have no interest in. And now I'm getting onto the substance of it. So if it's useful, then, yeah, I'll publish it. If it's not, I'll hopefully allow it to gather dust in a library somewhere.
Okay, last question.
Thank you, Richard. Hi, Kevin and Chris. I'm Zoe from the Fiji Consular and Trade Commission. Thank you for your insights this evening. I particularly just wanted to touch on the identity not crisis, but just the identity of what it means to be Australian. I think we're outward focused here, and I love that it's a think tank. It's fascinating to hear about the US and Chinese relations. But what do you think as a leader of Australia, noting that you gave reference in your fifth principle to a balanced relationship about being careful when you speak out, would you say that Australians are too quick to, maybe put down others, and we have to go back to understanding what it means to be an Australian today?
That's for you, Kevin.
I was going to say, I don't have to answer that one.
I was going to give you the hospital pass on that one, given that you now know me a bit. I think, a few basic realities which all Australians need to be aware of. There's 25 million of us in this vast region of 4 billion people. Of multiple civilizational trajectories and cultural histories, utterly alien to, frankly, the way most of us in this country have grown up. So my starting point is simply this, respect. That's something which doesn't necessarily come instinctively to the Australian way of thinking. But given the high cultures and civilizations which constitute our wider neighborhood, for me, that's kind of the entry point for discourse. Secondly, you know, as a bunch of, what are we, about 80% Anglo in this country these days? Something like that? I don't know. But, I've been preaching this message for 30 years now, but a much larger slab of us need to be comfortably bilingual and trilingual in our own region. Just as a matter of what I describe as disciplinary etiquette. This ginormous cultural assumption that English will remain the global lingua franca forever and a day shows an ahistoric view of the evolution of English, let alone what happened to French and Latin before it. You know, so I think that is a mark of respect. I always find I'm no longer conscious of this because I've been speaking Chinese for so long. But every now and then, a Chinese leader will say to you, "You know, it means a lot to us that you bothered."
Yeah.
Now, you probably had this experience as well, because as you know, it's not exactly easy. crazy language to learn. But if you're an Anglo and you grew up in rural Queensland, we struggle with English. But that was a joke too. Courier Mail and all those people up there from News Limited. But the point is, there's something to this, which is to recognise with a degree of humility where we are in this wider region. Cultures have been carving out their own way for literally thousands of years. And thirdly, as I say, in terms of the use of the megaphone, I'm not for avoiding the megaphone. I have used it myself from time to time, okay? But I've been very selective in its use, as opposed to what I'd say this to my friends in the Australian political class, Labor and Liberal. Thank God we never give foreign policy to the Nats, that's all I can say. You can laugh at that, Paul. It's okay. When you are using the megaphone purely for domestic political purposes, as Turnbull was in the Adalere Menjantilai statement, because he saw an open goal there, Dastiari, whatever it was that was going on, whack, then to have about in the political class a level of maturity and reflection about whether the use of the megaphone in dealing with Beijing or Jakarta or Delhi or whatever is actually prosecuting a core national interest or value as opposed to some grubby local politics. That's the discipline which has to be brought to bear. So I think they're the sort of things which I'd reflect on if, as Australians going forward.
Well, on that note, I'd like to really thank Kevin Rudd. I'm glad we pulled it off this time. And Chris Johnson, serendipitously in town as well. Thanks to you both for a terrific session.